Well, welcome. Hi, you've made it to Come, O Come, Emmanuel, Jesus, Israel, and the Gospel, in some order. My name is Chris Ridgway. I'm the Missionary Resources Director for GCM in Orlando, so I live down in Orlando, but it's fun to be sort of up here in the cold weather. We don't understand how to pack for this, but it works out. Turns out you can't use rollerboards as much as you need seven suitcases, so... What are we going to start with? How about we just start with, I'm just going to pick three people, and you can tell me your name and why you chose this one. And we'll start with hair. Hi, I'm Chris. Who are you?
I'm Mark. I'm from Kent State. And,
Because I'm always curious why people come to weird things named Jesus, Israel, and the Gospel. Why'd you come to this guy?
I actually chose it because you were leaning it. That was giving too much of that.
Yeah.
that was seriously why. And,
okay.
You study with Scott McNabb a little bit. I love Scott.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So fame. I'll take that. who else?
I'm Leah from Ball State.
I thought you were Leah.
Yeah.
Hi, Leah.
And I came because it sounded like it had some meat to it, some depth. I want to learn more about the Bible.
Meat and depth and Bible. Okay, we'll try for all those. Okay. back row, choose one of you. You all look dangerous.
I'm Joe from
Hi, Joe.
Missouri,
from Mizzou.
Really, I came because I play in the band at The Rock.
Yeah.
And we played this song, and I actually had a very long conversation with one of the other guys in the band about what The Rod of Jesse meant.
Nice.
And I read the description, and it seemed like it was meant to be.
We will define The Rod of Jesse. That's nicely done. Nicely done. I wish we could all say hi, but I figured we'd get a few of us to say hi. Hi, Sarah Brown.
Sarah Stewart.
Mr. Andy Stewart. Hello. Sarah Stewart. Sarah Stewart Brown. Hey, I figured I'd tell you, you sort of maybe a little bit of why you would show up for something like this. Let me tell you why I would teach something like this. You know, I've done workshops at a number of Ignites in a row, and you guys are sort of special because typically I don't do a workshop at Ignite that I haven't done somewhere else. That's not true here. I am making this up as I go. There's a lot of stuff that you're going to get from me that I've been working on and thinking on for 5 years or more, but I've never taught it in this setting. So if you don't mind, you're going to be a little bit of my test audience, and you can tell me how it went. It's going to be a little bit autobiographical in the sense that we're going to talk about theology and questions. We're going to talk about Jesus. We're going to talk about Israel and the Old Testament really as a whole. We're going to talk about the gospel, and somehow we're going to talk about Christmas carols. And we'll tie them together, but really it's going to be a little bit more of Chris doing a journey for me on what I've had an understanding over time of what the gospel means and what how the whole Bible figures into that. So I'm going to answer some of my own questions. They might not be the questions you've had. You might be like, yeah, that was great, but I got it. And that's fine, but I hope that with me sort of taking you through the journey of some questions that I've had, that it could be helpful for you. So that's sort of the goal for me. So I will tell you what questions I had and how I do it. Let's see. I figured I'd start with three photos. That's a photo. Another photo. My drawings are mostly, you know, representational, not so actual. We'll make them Polaroids, okay? There we go. But I thought I'd tell you a little bit more about me so you can understand about me, and I'll weave it into the photos so we can think about the topic and a little bit more about me, because oftentimes you want to know who the heck is talking about this. My short story is, my parents were not Christians when I was zero. My dad was in the Navy, and I grew up in a military family. We moved all over the world. I moved 21 times by the time I was 21, if you fudge the math. And my dad became a Christian, or my mom became a Christian while my dad was out to sea on a submarine, and some navigators, you know, the navigators shared the gospel with her, and she's like, wow, I'm a Christian now, plus I have a baby, which my husband has never seen. My dad comes home, and she goes, here's your baby, his name is Chris, and here's Jesus. And my dad becomes a Christian, and so I grew up in a Christian family that didn't have an extended Christian family of any kind. In fact, my extended family thinks we're complete kooks. But we moved around a lot, and we learned how to be a Christian family. My dad decides, gosh, this means so much to me that I'm actually going to get out of the Navy, go to seminary, and get back in the Navy, not as a nuclear engineer, but as a chaplain. And so I suddenly move around the world as a pastor's kid and a military kid and a missionary kid, sort of all wrapped into one. So I'm a little bit, you know, crazy. We'd move all these different places. And one of the places we moved, we'd be overseas. We were in Guam, and I lived in the Middle East and this kind of stuff. But we lived in Orlando for a year and a half. My dad was stationed at a Navy base there. No one knows why there's a Navy base in Orlando. There's no water in Orlando, but that's fine. And we went to a little Presbyterian church in town. Sometimes we go to these military chapels. Military chapels are weird things if you haven't been to them. They sort of look like a church, but they just have people that go sit in the pews and then leave, and there's not really a community. So when we'd be in the States, sometimes we'd go to a church in town. My dad was ordained Presbyterian, so we go to this Presbyterian church. And in sixth grade, I am in Orlando, and I'm trying very hard to be cool. I know this because my friend Chris Freeland had hypercolor shirts and body glove, and I didn't even understand what those were. He tried to teach me how to tight roll my jeans at that point, but I wasn't getting it. And the reason you know I was not getting it is because the highlight of my summer was Vacation Bible School in sixth grade. And I was asked by a Presbyterian church, hey, would you help out with Vacation Bible School, and would you, wait for it, do the puppets? I said, yes, absolutely. Love puppets. And so, you know, and so it's the whole thing on Monday morning when all the kids come in and there's music. There's 14,000 million preschoolers on the floor. And there's a, like, I don't know, we had a puppet stage of some kind. Did anyone do this with a PVC piping and some sort of black curtain? I stick my hand up the back of something, and I, you know, like we're doing this with an audio tape, you know, like, and we're dancing around in the back. And I'm in sixth grade and think it's the coolest thing. And it was. It was very, very cool. My puppet's name, I think, was Ernie. But Ernie and the other puppets told all sorts of stories, like Noah and Esther and all these sort of Old Testament stories. And I think of this as an image, as like, huh, these are all these stories I have of the Old Testament, you know, like puppet stories, stories that we all sort of heard about animals two by two, which is very difficult to do with puppets, let's just be clear. Did you have this? Did people grow up in Sunday school or VBS? So this is my VBS picture, picture number one. I thought of Esther and Noah. What other ones did you think of in this category?
Jonah.
Yeah, absolutely. Whales, puppet whales. Yeah, Jonah.
The lion's den.
Daniel, very good.
Jericho,
yeah. There's, you know, David and Goliath, right? Goliath, David, see representational, Joseph, in his dream coat of many colors, like Technicolor dream coat. Right, so this is VBS. That's sixth grade. Let me go back into my story and we'll do a second picture. We grew up moving around, but with my dad being a preacher and this kind of stuff, I don't know if this happens to you, you get in high school and I start getting real frustrated with my family, and actually me and my dad fight a lot. And he's real different than me. He's sort of quiet and likes math, and I'm not. And, you know, and but I mean, we just clashed. He'd preach, and I'd sit in the second row like a good Christian kid, and then we'd go home and we'd just scream at each other in the house, you know, really loud. And to the point where I have memories of my mom crying, trying to just say, "Stop it, stop fighting," you know. And when I left for college, I wanted to get the F out of my house. If that makes sense, like that strongly. And I said, and for me, my house was also Christianity. So I'm like, my dad is a pastor, it's Christianity, I don't want to have anything to do with this. So I'm going to go to University of Illinois. We moved from Japan to Chicago for 10 months, and I went to U of I. And I said, and I'm going to do everything I can to have nothing to do with Christianity. And so I did. There was a checklist online. This was the internet was new. But we had a checklist online on things you can do to not be pure. It was mostly sex, alcohol, and drugs. And I figured this is a checklist. I'll try these things. That was when I was 18 until, gosh, God really broke me down. And there's a whole story, but I really got Wayne Wager at GCM is a guy that I called up when I was really in trouble. He took me out to a coffee shop and gave me a hug and said, do you really want to turn your life around? I said, absolutely. There was another guy that was involved. His name was Jim Johnson. He was on staff with GCM, another campus missionary. And him and Wayne had talked, and he took me out to a Wendy's on campus about, I don't know, a few days later after I talked with Wayne, and he said, hey, let's have lunch and let's go to Wendy's because that's cool. And so we go to this campus town, we go to Wendy's, and very greasy, we sit in a booth next to a fake plant, and he's talking, he's like, hey, I wonder if I could show you something that someone showed to me about what it means to go to heaven. I said, yeah, I guess, sure. And so he takes a napkin, turns Wendy face down, and starts drawing on the napkin, right? And he does something like this, right? Have you seen it? He says, this is God, and God is holy, right? And he says, and this is people over here, and people are self-centered, and again, I'm just sort of scribbling, self-centered and rebellious or independent. Have you heard this? And then he's like, and this is a big problem, because sin is the separation between a holy God and people that are self-centered and sinful. And the sin leads to death. But there's a way out of this. That's through Jesus. And this is his cross. It bridges the gap. And if I believe, we can cross over to God. And so he draws the bridge diagram for me. And something that maybe most of us have seen, right? And most of us maybe have even shared with somebody else. Jim did it with a whole lot of verses on it. This was amazing for me, right? I thought, oh my gosh, I grew up in this Christian family. I know all these sort of catechism kind of things, but actually the simplicity of God's grace for me is amazing, you know, and this picture really helps me. Interesting thing about this is all New Testament verses on this, he wrote these verses down. He'd write holy, and he'd write a verse, and he'd write self-centered, and he'd write a verse, and there are all these verses from the New Testament about the story of the gospel. This is my Wendy's picture. Just so you know, last thing about me, I guess I go through college, and I actually turn my life around at that point, or God turns my life around, gosh. And I wound up learning to share the gospel on my dorm floor and lead worship in my church, and then I decide I'm going to be a Microsoft consultant, and then I said that's a dumb idea because that's Microsoft Windows, and I decided to fly down to Florida and raise support as a campus missionary, and then I'm a campus missionary at the University of Illinois for a number of years. And in the intervening, just so you know, I got to, after leaving Illinois in 2006, I was able to finish a master's degree in theology, and so just my angle here is going to be theological. And now I wound up in Orlando in this missionary resources director job. That's the story. I was trying to do gaps for the story so you know where I come from. But I have one third picture. This picture is when I would fly home. My parents kept on moving while I stayed in Illinois, and they'd be in the Middle East, they'd be in Seattle, they were in Washington, D.C., and every Christmas, even while I was a student, but also while I was on staff, I'd fly to where they were, and we'd go home to church with the family one time for the year. It was at Christmas. I don't know if you do this. And we'd go and sit in whatever church they were sort of going to at the time, and there'd be pews, and they'd do a lesson in carols for Christmas. Like, have you done this at your church? It's sort of traditional where there's a family, there's some candles up front, they all stand up, they read a verse, and we all sing the carol that goes with that verse, and then they sit down, and then someone else stands up, and we sing another Christmas carol, and it sort of tells the story of Christmas. Well, some of us have done it, I guess some of us haven't seen that, but it's sort of traditional. You wind up seeing everything. It's Joy to the World and Silent Night. And O Come Emmanuel. This is my favorite Christmas song. Every time this one would come up in the carol service, I was like, this is amazing. First of all, it's in a minor key, and that just sounds mysterious. And second of all, there's all these random phrases in it, like Rod of Jesse and Ransom Captive Israel, and it has this hauntingness to it of this bigger story. And so I have this memory of this song, standing there with my family, sort of looking on the aisle, us holding the candles. You know, you hold the candles in the candlelight service and singing this song and going, wow, it's amazing, but I feel like I'm not getting it completely. And this is my, so this is my Christmas picture. Okay, those are my three pictures. I was going to say something after the three pictures. What have I got? Actually, for the song, I figured we'd listen to it for a second. I was playing it for you. I looked up on Spotify. Is everyone on Spotify? Is everyone cool at this point? Okay. Spotify, turns out this is a popular song for more than just me. There are 1,060 recordings of O Come, O Come, Emmanuel by cover artists. You'll be happy to know that they include not only Sufjan Stevens and the David Carter Band, but also Enya, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and thankfully Jessica Simpson. She has a version, so I, you know, run and download that. Which one would you like to listen to? Jessica Simpson, right? Sufjan, I think we do Sufjan. I have some lyrics for you. Let me grab one of these. What's that? So curious about Jessica's, yeah. Yeah. On your own time. I'm giving you a handout. On one side, it has a traditional hymn-looking version of the lyrics of O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, and I thought we'd listen to it just a little bit together before we continue. You know what? You thought wrong, but that's nice. Yeah. He might not do all the verses in the same order. We'll see. Probably does a lot more verses, but it makes more sense to just read them. It's nice, huh? Sufjan's sort of version,
yeah.
The banjo, and I could talk a lot about the history of the hymn. I'm not going to. It was originally in Latin. Well, originally it might be older than that, but it was these phrases that a church might sing back and forth to each other called antiphones, and they'd sing these phrases about God, and then the other choir would sort of answer, echoing back and forth in the church. And then this version is by a guy named John Mason Neal, and he translates it in the 1850s or so, and that's sort of the version we know. When I was listening to this song, standing in my parents' church with the candles, I started realizing this song is sharing the gospel. I've always liked the song. It's always felt a lot like Christmas, and with phrases like Rod of Jesse and Captive Israel and Key of David, it's actually always felt a lot like VBS, too, to me. My VBS picture, Old Testament-y, somehow. But it never really felt like it had much to do with Wendy's, actually, with my gospel picture, with the story of the bridge and how I'm reconnected to God. It never felt like it connected into that. But now, in my progression over 5 years of trying to stare at this and see what God is teaching me out of scriptures, I go, gosh, it has everything to do with Wendy's. And so the point of what we're going to try to do today is I'm going to try to say we can't actually share the gospel as well with others without telling the Old Testament story. And I'd like to show you a little bit why I think that, and maybe then try to sort of get into about how it could work even practically. So that's what I'm doing, if that makes sense. To get into the gospel and Wendy's, we're going to have to go to whole new pictures, and we're going to have to talk a little bit about what the gospel is. Now, we did an entire Ignite on what the gospel was last time. That was the theme. So there's no way we're going to do more than a few minutes here. But sometimes we all know the gospel, but sometimes it can be super hard to summarize very short. And it's tough. And I wonder if we could even try it out. And if you have a pen and a paper that I gave you or a notebook or something with you, maybe we'd take a minute and just try to sketch down for a little bit. If you had to say to a friend, hey, this is the gospel and I have two sentences to say this to you, what do you write? Some of us might have this down cold. We're like, oh yeah, we got that. And some of us might be like, oh gosh, I don't know. Why don't you try it out? Take a minute here and so if I had two sentences to say to a friend, gosh, this is sort of the gospel, I got to fit in the most important stuff right up front. Does anyone want to be, you know, crazy and try it? Sort of say to us what?
You're going to hate this. This wasn't on purpose. I said rescued, reconciled, restored, and redeemed.
Good, yeah. Yeah, all alliteration's my favorite. You're right. So good for memory. We all remember there's four R words, and then we don't know what they are. but, no, it's good. Anyone else want to try?
You said two sentences?
Sure. Let's be clear, those weren't sentences, so you're probably going to be good.
Oh, okay. You have sinned and fallen short of God's glory.
Yeah.
But God loves you, sent his son, and paid your price for you on the cross, so accept Jesus.
So come on, accept Jesus. Very nice, good, man, yeah. Right, yeah, and so if we were even talking, if we're even thinking about this picture in the middle, my try was, you know, you and me are sinful and self-centered. I'm sort of repeating this language, and God is holy. But God, through Jesus, died for our sins and forgave us, and all you need to do, you hear that phrase a lot, is accept the free gift of grace to be forgiven and saved. Right? So we have these different tries, and some things incorporate more or less. So I did, Mark mentioned that this professor that I really like a lot, his name is Scott McKnight. He's a Bible professor in Chicago, and an expert on the New Testament, and I got to work for him for a couple years. When I was in Chicago finishing my seminary degree, and so I do research things for him and work on commentaries and stuff for him, which was super cool. And I'd go up to his office on Tuesdays, and I'd sit with him in his office, and we'd just sort of talk about whatever was going on, and then he'd have projects that he'd like me to do. And so one time he's like, okay, Chris, here's what I'm doing. I'm working on the gospel. He's been working on the gospel for 15 years or something. Professors do that kind of thing. They work on the same thing. I'm working on the definition of the gospel, and here's my project for you. He's like, I need you to go do a search of the A&EMP and post-Nicene Fathers. I'll get to that in a minute. And look for the word gospel when the church fathers wrote about the gospel. well, who did he mean by the church fathers? He sort of meant, you know, if you read Acts and you sort of see the church sort of starts and then Jesus takes off, and then what happens right after Acts? Well, the next couple hundred years right after Acts, there's all these amazing pastors and churches as the gospel spreads throughout. A lot of them have writings, too, that you can study if you've looked at that. And they have all sorts of good articulations of what the church should be and the gospel is as it spreads out into different cultures and things. And so the church fathers are these kind of people. And he said there's these resources when you're a nerd to go and look. They have collected all these writings. You can sort of search through. And he said, search for every time they use the word gospel. I want to and pull quotes from me. So I'd sit up late at night. I was working on my research, but then I had to get to his research. And late at night, and I'd be searching through online. Fortunately, this stuff's all online now. And find these words. And we use Greek and English and did some stuff with some text. And I'd copy and paste out quotes. So here's a quote on the gospel. I'd copy into a Word document and copy some other ones, and so I could give it to him, some charts. I kept on searching for the word gospel in a number of ways, and I'd always get a quote that was something like, well, in the gospel by the writer Matthew, and I go like, we see Jesus' life and this kind of stuff. I'm like, oh, they're talking about like the gospels, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, because we use the word gospels for that too, right? I was like, but that's not what I was looking for. I am looking for the two-sentence summary statement. So I'd keep on searching. I'd search again, and I'd find more about, well, the gospel writers, Luke, John, and I'd get sort of frustrated. I'm like, I'm doing something wrong. And I kept on searching, and it turns out I only found references in the 200 or 300 years to the gospels as written in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and I never found the word gospel that had anything to do with what this Wendy's picture seemed to be. There's stuff about Jesus, tons and tons of stuff about Jesus. They're all talking about Jesus. When we shared the gospel, the story of Jesus with X, or when the gospel came to us, but it was always about Jesus' birth, life, teaching, death, resurrection, everything. And I went back to Scott and said, man, I'm not getting it, but this is what I think. All these guys are only talking about the gospels like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And he's like, no, you're getting it. And he already sort of knew this. He's like, for the early church writer, he's like, the gospels are the gospel. Does that make sense? So there's two gospels. Like, and this might be like so obvious to you. And it was like, oh, huh, to me, you know. Two gospels. Gospel one was this sense of like, this is the bridge diagram, and this is, has an amazing central summary of truths about how God connects to us. But there is this gospels, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and everyone seemed to write about the gospel. They were talking about this, the whole story of Jesus. I was like, I like this idea. The gospel is really the entire story of Jesus. Like, I'm very cool with that. You know, that's true, isn't it? Like, let's talk about Jesus. That's, you know, everything that Jesus did, including his death, but the whole life and story of Jesus. Yeah, so I sort of felt like I was getting it. I sort of felt like the Princess Bride. This word does not mean what you think it means. Is that, okay, or still old enough to get the reference. So, you know, I was like, well, this is great. The gospel is in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Let's start with Matthew 1:1. Did anyone bring a Bible? Matthew 1:1. Who's a reader? You know, loud, obnoxious, clear reader. Okay, loud, obnoxious, clear. I was like, the gospel's right there at the beginning of Matthew, verse 1. Why don't you start with verse 1?
A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham.
Okay. Gosh, well, the story of Jesus, there it is. First word is Jesus Christ. Awesome. He put a couple other people in there. A little distracting. We could have just left it Jesus, but that's fine. Verse 2, I'm sure he's going to get to Jesus.
Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, his mother's Tamar.
Okay, that's verse 3, and a little off track, but he's going to get to Jesus. Verse 4.
Abraham the father of Aminadab, Aminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of
Sin. No. Keep Jesus, come on. 6? Verse 6?
And Jesse the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon. His mother had been Uriah.
Verse 8. You know what? Skip to verse 18.
This is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph. But before they came together, she was found to be a child through the Holy Spirit.
That's where Christmas starts. I thought that. Oh, gosh. Matthew, he's a nice guy, but he gets very easily distracted as a writer, is what I'm saying. Because this is supposed to be the story of Jesus, and this guy's a tangent machine for at least 17 verses. Boring as all. Let's get straight to it, right? You know, like, what is God doing with Matthew? Unfortunately, Luke winds up doing a lot of the same thing, right? You know, let's just quit Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Let's just try Paul, right? We know Paul is all about the straight-up gospel. So, you know, Paul has all sorts of sermons about the gospel in Acts, Acts 2, Acts 3, Acts 4, Acts 10, Acts 11, Acts 14, Acts 13, Acts 17, Paul and Peter both. Why don't we go to one of those and see if Paul would get straight to Jesus if he's going to tell the story of Jesus? How about Acts 3? Does someone want to, who else wants to read? Acts 3, verse 16. Who's a reader? Excellent. Why don't you read like try through verse 22? You can do 16 through 22.
Yeah. And his name, by faith in his name, has made this man strong, whom you see and know.
Oh, did I get that wrong? 3:16.
17 starts with friend. Well.
So Paul stood up and gestured with his hand. Am I in verse 12, or am I in the wrong chapter?
Acts 3.
Yeah, that'd be early.
That was Peter.
That's Peter.
Yeah.
No. What chapter am I in then?
13, 16.
I'm in 13. I missed the one, didn't I? We could do Acts 3 too. It would work. But let's try Acts 13. Let's Acts 13 because that's where I went. Thank you. Acts 13, 16.
So Paul stood up and motioned with his hand, said, "Men of Israel, and you who fear God, listen."
Okay, here comes the gospel.
"The God of this people Israel chose our fathers and made the people great during their stay in the land of Egypt. And with uplifted arm, he led them out of it.
Oh gosh.
For about 40 years, he put up with them in the wilderness. And after destroying seven nations in the land of Canaan,
Jesus,
he gave the land as an inheritance. All this took about 450 years. And after that..."
Yeah, your talk is taking 450 years. Gets Jesus.
"Then they asked for a king, and God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up David to be their king. I have found in David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will."
Thanks. Gosh, Paul's off his rocker too. Seriously, we need to talk about the story of Jesus, and he's going off on, I don't know, Kish? You know, why the heck did Matthew and Paul, when given the chance to stand up and share the Gospels, talk to about Jesse, Canaan, and Kish? You know? Here's the problem. Starting with Jesus, the story of Jesus, it's a little bit like starting with the action scene at the end of the movie. There's explosions. There's a bridge that has some sort of digital timer and a dark room with three men and computers. There is a, there's four things happening at once, and there's a woman that's in distress of some kind. And there's a car flying over the bridge to get to the woman. And it's really cool, and there's great special effects, but unless you watch the whole front part of the movie, you have no idea who any of the characters are. Starting with Jesus sometimes is a little bit like starting with the action scene at the end of the movie. But we've got to start earlier to know who the characters are, to see everything that was happening with what Jesus does, right? And this is, I think, what Matthew and Paul and others are doing. They're setting the scene for everything that Jesus does. So here's the scene. You guys following me so far? We doing okay? All of Old Testament history in 2 minutes, maybe. That's not true. There's no way that's going to happen. Abraham to David. And you don't have all this, and that's okay. We'll do David to the exile. And exile to the Messiah. Abraham to David, David to the exile, exile to the Messiah. Three different groups of history. If I start with my Old Testament and start reading, these are sections of history that we sort of would all know. Like, we know U.S. history, we know, gosh, there was the Revolutionary War, and then they signed the Declaration of Independence, and at some point we cut it off and start thinking about when the presidents happened, right? And so those are different segments. Same thing here with Israel. Abraham to David, so this is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the fathers and the nation, early Genesis, right? Genesis 1 through 11 asks a question. It says, the world went horribly wrong when Adam and Eve chose to be their own king. In Genesis 12, and through the rest of the Bible, answers the question of what God's going to do about it, right? Abraham is the first person he starts with. He says, there's this guy, old guy, and you're going to be part of the solution. Abraham's sort of faithful. He follows God across, over the Fertile Crescent and into other land, but he's sort of not faithful in a lot of ways. Laughs when God says, kids, all the way through David, the king who's sort of faithful and amazing, man after God's own heart, and sort of really not faithful, Bathsheba and a whole lot of other things. Matthew knows this, and so if you go back to Matthew 1, Do you see that the first seven verses are Abraham through David? Right there, he does these names, and he says that. Then he starts with David on the second seven verses, Matthew does, and he says, David to the exile. By the way, when Matthew does this, he does seven names here, and seven names here in the genealogy, Matthew 1, 1 through 17. David to the exile, the king. The exile... Right, you remember how Israel, right after David and after Solomon, gets split up into two kingdoms because of fighting, right? Israel and Judah. Israel gets real bad real fast. It's a bigger section of land, but they wind up getting carted off by the Assyrians in like 721, I think. The Babylonians come by about 150 years later in like 586 and take them off. And they're both parts of the judgments of God on Israel and Judah. And they're struggling, right? They're not following God. They're not being faithful. There are good kings in there that are faithful, but many that are not. And so when we say the word exile, every Israel, most of the time, we think Babylonian, but every Jew goes, oh, exile, that's when we all got deported from Jerusalem and taken away to a different place and we were no longer home. And Jerusalem was God's city, so it was like being removed from God. And so now we're in exile. Exile to the Messiah. The Babylonians let the Jews come back to Jerusalem, right? Do you know this story? They come back and they start trying to rebuild the temple. Nehemiah builds a wall and this kind of thing. But they're still sort of under Babylon, and then other things happen. There's Greeks and Seleucids, and then the Romans, and this is all world history class from like 7th grade, and we're like, phew. But even when Jesus comes along, Israel's still under Rome. They're sort of there in their own land, but they're not really in their own land. They're not really in charge. And a lot of people think, gosh, we still feel like we're sort of separated from our own, even though we're there at Jerusalem, we're still sort of separated. We're still a little bit in exile. God is still holding us off. There are so many verses in there, I guess it just would not be, there's no way I can read them all, but Isaiah, there's all the prophets deal with all this stuff, but Isaiah 26, can someone do Isaiah 26, 17 for me? 17 and 18. Because the story of Israel is a little bit of a trail of tears, where God is reaching in and helping, and then people are not faithful, or things are not good, and they are struggling to do what God intended for Israel to be, which is a blessing to the whole world. And the prophets say this all the time. They go, this isn't working. And Isaiah chapter 26, 17 and 18 phrases it in a really poignant way. Sarah, do you want to read it?
Just as a pregnant woman writhes and cries out in pain as she gives birth, so were we in your presence, Lord. We too writhe in agony, but nothing comes of our suffering. We have not given salvation to the earth, nor brought life into the world.
Yeah. We've not given, so I have a different translation. Mine says, we cannot produce deliverance on the earth. We've not brought salvation to the world. It's an image of this pregnant woman that can't give birth. It's like a people that were chosen, but it couldn't follow through because of sin and unfaithfulness. through generations after generation, couldn't do it. This is the movie before Jesus, the action scene, right? The one question is, so how did Jesus answer all the problems here in his life? And I have a, do I want to do that? See, this is the test audience for sure. I'm skipping stuff and trying to say what's good for us. Yes, this is what I'd say. Jesus, does he know this story? He absolutely knows this story. This is the story that forms Jesus' whole identity when he shows up in Israel and knows, gosh, we were the people of God, but we've really messed it up. It's really not working the way it was planned. And I suggest this is the story from which he required his whole identity and mission. And it's the story to which he gave all the significance and authority. And I love this part in Jesus' life in Luke 24 at the end. Do you remember this? Were you just thinking that? Right.
Yeah.
After the resurrection, right? And I'll just read this, Luke 24:13. Now on the same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus. Right? Do you know this? About 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. And they were talking and discussing, and Jesus himself came near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, what are you discussing with each other while you walk along? And they stood still, looking sad. And then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him. He said, are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place in these last days? He asked them, what things? And they replied, the things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. And how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Do you hear redeem Israel as a massively pregnant phrase with everything here? Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since all these things have taken place. Moreover, some women in our group astounded us. They were at a tomb early this morning. When they did not find his body there, they came back and told us what they had indeed seen, a vision of angels that said he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the woman said, but they did not see him. And then he said to them, oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe in all the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary for the Messiah to suffer these things and enter his glory? And then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. Love that. Here's a few of the things he might have said. Do you see the chart on here that says Jesus? I want to point out just real quickly a bunch of things that Jesus does in his life that we see the story of Jesus is actually the completion of the story of Israel. The story of Jesus is the completion of the story of Israel, and this matters to us. And some of these things are, gosh, super common. You might know a lot of these things, but I grew up in an evangelical church that really didn't talk about some of these things, even though they're in there. They just weren't as common. And you might have heard a lot of this or may not have heard any of it. Because I just thought, you know, gosh, Jesus' death and resurrection are all that matter, and gosh, it's in some ways it's massive, but everything he did in his life sort of reflects back on this story. So one on there I have East, right? Jesus East. By the way, the other column is Israel. Israel. A professor named Chris Wright says the great bulk of history recorded in the Hebrew Bible, that's the Old Testament, is flung like a great hammock between the pole of Egypt and Babylon. What do we mean? Well, Egypt is where Israel starts, right, with Moses and they're trapped and were enslaved, and then God rescues them, right? That's Egypt. Egypt and God rescues them is the paradigm of the gospel in the Old Testament. God is the one who rescues. God is the one that frees you from slavery and brings you into freedom, right? That's the whole gospel there. By the way, can we just say Sinai and the law happens after Exodus? God gives the law after he frees. God first shows grace and frees, and then shows how to live. This is the pattern of God through all time. If we ever hear us saying, gosh, the Old Testament was a weird God that sort of made us, you try to work up to it, and if you worked up to it, then he'd free you. That's not the story of the Old Testament. The story is that he frees first, and then he shows you how to live. Exodus and Sinai. But that was a throw-off. That was a... the East. Exodus is in the East. Exodus in the Egypt is in the East. Oh, gosh. Exodus in the East. Am I totally... I'm totally off in my directions, aren't I? West and East are bad for me. Here's what I have to do. I draw the United States, and it looks like a trapezoid sort of to me. Here's Florida. That's West... That's East. I'm wrong. Right? Because let's try me doing Africa. There's Egypt. Here's Sinai. Here's Israel. This is water. That's great. So are we getting that map? Yeah. yeah, this is a problem. If we're in Israel here, this is actually West. Perfect. And then this is East over here, Babylon. And so I was talking about East at the thing. What I was really explaining was West, Egypt. And from the West... where does Jesus go when he's young? Goes down to West, goes down to Egypt. That happens because, why? Because they're afraid of for his life, but why else does it happen? Jesus comes out of Egypt and comes back to Israel, I think refiguring what happened with Israel. If you talk about the East and Babylon, we talked, and I didn't really describe the whole scene when Babylon comes and conquers Jerusalem in 586 and ports them all away and knocks down the whole city and burns it. You know who comes from the East when Jesus is born? Christmas, anyone? Magi. Like, so you have from the West and from the East. These are images of this whole story of Israel that was failed that start working into Jesus' life. There's a lot of these. I don't think they're all accidental. I don't think they're even close to accidental. The prophets talk about all of these. Matthew 2, Hosea 11, when Israel was a young man, I loved him like a son, and I summoned my son out of Egypt. But baptism in the Jordan River, this is the next one, right? Baptism, I say. Jesus goes and gets baptized. A lot of times we'd ask, we go, gosh, you know, I'd sit down with a student and say, hey, let's talk about you being baptized. You know, like this is the next right step for you in your Christian life in obedience to God. And it is. When someone has said, I'm going to follow Jesus, I'm going to go get baptized. Awesome. Jesus got baptized. We do it because he did it. Why did Jesus do it? You know what? To be honest, as a staff member, I had a fake answer for that because I was a little bit weirded out by that. Why did Jesus get baptized? I thought baptism was for repentance of sins. If Jesus doesn't sin, why does he get baptized? So another answer was like, well, he did it as an example, so we'd do it. Could be nice. You could do it, so we did it so the Holy Spirit would show up with a dove there, but that could have happened other places, I think. I think there was something about going to the Jordan River. Israel, when they wander around for 40 years and they come to the Jordan River and they're going to pass in the Promised Land, they pass through the Jordan. Jesus, when he's going to start his ministry, passes through the Jordan River. Baptism in Jordan, I think it's Israel passing through the Jordan. I think Jesus actually knows what's going on. Let's talk about 40 days. After he goes out in the Jordan, he goes out to be tempted, right, by the devil. For 40 days in the wilderness. Do you know the story, right? And he fasts. And we fast 40 days. And he gets all these temptations, right? Gosh, what if you just turn stones into bread? And he starts quoting Deuteronomy. Rich Mullins did a weird old Christian song called Quoting Deuteronomy to the Devil in like the 80s. He's quoting Deuteronomy because this has everything to do with the story of Israel and Israel wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. It has everything to do with Israel wandering the 40 years in the wilderness and not doing it right. An unfaithful Israel was like, God, you brought us out here and we don't even have food to eat. And Jesus says, I trust God for food. Jesus trusts God where Israel did not trust God, even though he provides. We talk about the temple, throwing yourself from the temple. Let's talk about Sinai, trusting from high places, trusting God. Is God. Literally, Jesus is walking back in footsteps of what Israel did poorly and Jesus does right. Disciples, how many disciples does Jesus pick? How many tribes of Israel are there? Right. In the body and blood, when we do communion, when we, or in a very traditional church, you say celebrate Eucharist, and you have the bread and the wine, the body and blood of Christ, the Last Supper, right in the upper room. Remember do you remember the feast that they were celebrating, Jesus and his disciples? What were they celebrating with the blood and the Passover, right? What's Passover about? Redemption from slavery in Egypt, right? And you have the blood that goes back to the lamb that the God said, hey, paint this on your doorposts as salvation, as mercy over your sins, right? Jesus is taking us back into this massive, amazing story of what God has done through all history. Oh, man. Well, at 4:25.
Yes, Chris, I also thought when you mentioned the body and blood, I also thought of the passage of John where he compares eating his body to the manna. As God gave manna.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a massive echo too. There's so many echoes, and I would like to talk for maybe 15 hours with us about all the different things that Jesus does. That'd be ridiculous, and also, you know, it'd be warm in here. But here's what I want to try to do. My friend Andrew actually walked in and go, we didn't talk, so I didn't think she was coming, but here she is. I'm so glad. No, I'm glad you're here. We're going to get to listen to the song one more time, and just actually, Andrew's going to get to sing it for us a little bit. But let me tell you how I think this can practically work if we're trying to share the gospel, because I know this is a theology track. I was trying to get you a lot of that. But I mean, there's this practical, if I really want to share the real gospel with people and see their lives changed, and how am I supposed to pull out Matthew chapter 1 and start reading names to someone that doesn't know the gospel? That doesn't make any sense. Like, how does this have any practical application? I'm going to give you really quick points. Can I fire them at you? And then we can talk about after if you want more. I think the gospel is story-sized. If you go to Denny's and suddenly you see Jessica Simpson at Denny's, and that's just because our Jessica Simpson reference earlier, and you're like, and, you know, I don't know, you're ordering Moons Over My Hammy, and there's Jessica Simpson, and you're like, oh my God, Jessica Simpson's in Champaign, Illinois. And you go home and talk about this. This is at least a 45-minute story for most of us. Okay? Right? Like, I am going to go to my small group and talk forever about how amazing it was. You know, whatever, that kind of thing. The gospel, the most amazing story that covers all of God's working through history and Jesus redoing the history, maybe this story takes longer than 5 minutes. Maybe the two sentences are okay sometimes, but what if we had hours to tell this story? One practical suggestion I have is I think the bridge diagram and other summaries of the gospel can be really great. But at the same time, I think, gosh, I really wish I could have a student that's curious about the gospel and wants to talk. I'm like, hey, let's sit down and read the book of John together. Or read the gospel of Luke together and meet each week and talk through the story of Jesus. You know, To root it in something. Another thing, the gospel is a person. So the gospel is story-sized. The gospel is a person. Jesus is a real person in history and time and space. And it's not just an abstract principle about a God who loves us and has a wonderful plan for our life. Well, that's crazy true. But there's a real creator who's working out of real history in and out. And my suggestion is, let's focus on the story of Jesus more, the history of Jesus, more than an abstract concept of going, you have sinned. Sin will show up when people look at the story of Jesus. People will start seeing themselves in relationship to Jesus. But if we start with an abstract concept of sin in heaven, we don't have a whole lot to relate it to. Let's relate it to earth. And sin and heaven are all in there. They're real. Gives us a better foundation. 3, the gospel solves a bigger problem than us. It does solve, let me quote this quote, if the story of Israel finds its completion in the story of Jesus, and that's the gospel, then we must find the problem within the fabric and contours of Israel's stories and not just the my needs story. Does the gospel answer all our fears, our anxieties, our sin? Yes, individually. But is it an even bigger story than we are getting, than us, and we get swept up into the story? Yes, because it's been starting since Adam and Eve and all through time. Let's get swept up into that story. If we do a disservice to the people we're sharing the gospel with, because they're going to, if we keep it at the individual level, I guess is my idea. And, you know, the last one is the gospel is a declaration. Jesus is king. What are you going to do about it? I really think this is part of the story because Jesus is the creator and king and made the whole thing. And the gospel is not just an invitation. We say the gospel is an invitation a lot. It has an invitation in it. But it's not just an invitation. It's not just that, hey, you're a sinner and God loves you. Would you like to be forgiven? That is massive part of the gospel. Don't forget it. Don't lose it. But it's in this bigger story of Jesus is the king, the one that created and is making everything else right. Do you want to be part of it? Jesus is king. What are you going to do about it? It's a declaration of the story of what reality is. And the last one is the gospel is complex and deep. Sometimes you hear people say the gospel is so simple a child can get it. I believe that. It's true. But let's not let that swing us to the other side to say, well, gosh, there's nothing more to that. The gospel is incredibly amazing and complex and God working in and out of details. And we can dive in so deep. And so don't feel forced to oversimplify.
Hey, Christopher Bass, is Rod of Jesse just...
I didn't do it, did I? I skipped it.
David's father, because Jesse's David's father.
Rod and stem are the same word, right? And stem is the family tree idea. And so, Rod of Jesse, and did you guys come up with this? It's this story of David, and I forgot to put Jesse here, right? Jesse is David's father. Sometimes it was better to talk about the father, to talk about the person. And so, out of Jesse comes David, and that through that comes Jesus, right? It's a reference to the whole family tree. All of Matthew's thing, all the way through Jesus. The rod of Jesse, it's just, you know, the massively great-great-grandfather, and there comes Jesus.
Chris, I think it helps if you flip it. Jesse, like the roots, and going up to David, and up to these, the rod.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure, that's really good. Well, you guys have been my good test audience on the content. Andrew, would you sing two verses of this for us? There are a lot. I was thinking just, one and five. I was going to say 1, 3, and 5, but how about 1 and 5? Is that okay?
Sure.
Why don't we use this last just listening as just we can sort of appreciate everything that God has done in all of history, both Israel and for us, to change the world, and just sort of use this as a prayer in our hearts as we listen to Andrew. So.
And up open. Make safe the way that leads on high, and close the path to misery. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee.
Amen.